You're listening to Innovation. I'm Kara Hetland, and joining me now from the Janine Basinger Studio on the campus of South Dakota State University is Assistant Professor Rob Lonsinger. He's with the Department of Natural Resource Management. Welcome to Innovation. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me, Kara. I really appreciate it.
So you're working on two separate projects about managing bobcats. So let's start with the first one about using just some information that you're gathering from hunters and trappers.
Yeah, so the first project is it's a really interesting project because we have a lot of data that comes from animals, such as bobcats, but bobcats in this case, that are related to data that we get through hunters or trappers. And so this is an enormous amount of data that we can't get as easily or as efficiently using more traditional research approaches. And so this project, we have a master student who will be essentially using hunter-harvested data. So in other words, what I mean by that is tissue samples collected by these by Fish and Game, or I'm sorry, South Dakota Game, Fish and Parks. between states, I always get them switched up. So using these hunter-harvested samples to look at population genetics for bobcats, trying to inform management and improve management. So some of the things that we're interested in is, what on the landscape, highways, roads, the Missouri River, what influences bobcat movements, and how can we then use that to improve management of bobcats and bobcat persistence long-term in the state.
And you can tell this from their tissue, from their genetics?
Absolutely, yeah. So we essentially can take the genetic data. We can look at what's called population genetic structure, which essentially describes how populations are structured on the landscape in terms of how they're related to one another. So we can look at the relatedness between different individuals, and that tells us something about what population they belong to.
And so do you have other data that tells you about the population in general to know how you can track its movement? Is that I'm trying to figure out the best way to ask that question. Where's your base knowledge, I guess?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different ways that researchers look at movement of animals. So probably the one that people think of first and foremost is radio collaring. So we put a radio collar on animal, we go out, we track it. It moves from point A to point B, and we make some inference about what might have influenced its movement path. So maybe it avoided roads, or maybe it used a particular corridor of habitat. In contrast, we can look at it through genetics. And so I should mention that this traditional approach of using radio telemetry can be really challenging because, well, for one, capturing bobcats is actually challenging. So capturing most carnivores is challenging. Radio collars are expensive. And in addition to being expensive, they require that you go out and track these animals very closely, which requires a lot of field work and field labor. And consequently, what ends up happening is we end up with really small sample sizes. And so we can learn some anecdotal information about bobcat movements, for example, what features influence them, what features might facilitate movement or impede movement in some way. But that inference is based on a really small, relatively speaking, sample size. With harvest data, so using bobcat data from trappers, we have data now from, I think, we're using 4 years of sampling from 2015 through this past harvest season, and we'll be using harvest data from this year. And we get about 350 bobcats harvested in the state a year on average. So that's going to give us a sample size of over 1,500 bobcats. And so between those, now we can look at the relatedness between individuals. That tells us something about how they move, and we can correlate that movement with sort of models of landscape connectivity, which is a little bit complex, but allows us to look at movement in a much more robust manner than just using radio telemetry.
So just briefly, just a summary of hunting licenses for bobcats and what that all entails for the hunter. To have that many, to trap and to hunt a bobcat in South Dakota, what does that mean? And then what type of tissue sample do they send in?
Yeah, great question. So bobcats, they are closely regulated in South Dakota as well as in other states. Bobcats are actually regulated under an international treaty called the Convention for the International Trade of Endangered Species, or CITES for short. And essentially the reason they're they're monitored so closely is not because their populations are necessarily in decline. We actually believe they're quite robust, but primarily because they are closely or they're similar in appearance to lynx, which are a much more closely regulated species that is not doing quite as hot on a global scale. And so for that reason, bobcat trappers or hunters are required to bring any animal that they capture to be checked by a state game, fish, and parks employee and to be tagged with this international CITES tag so that they can ensure it is indeed a bobcat. And so that really facilitates our ability to get this data and get it efficiently and effectively. I'm not sure exactly how many bobcat trappers there are in the state, but I can tell you that their contribution is invaluable to us.
Well, and sometimes it might not be on purpose.
Generally speaking, it is intentional. Mm-hmm. We do get some samples that come from unintentional mortalities. So what I mean by that is, for example, we do have a couple samples that come from road kills each year. We have additional samples that might come from animals that were trapped as part of another research study or something along those lines. But for the most part, the harvested samples are intentionally trapped for their fur bearing, essentially for the fur that they possess.
And so it's a state Game, Fish, and Parks employee then that takes the sample and sends it to you.
Yeah. So
not the hunter.
It is not the hunter directly or trapper directly. No, they are trapping the animal, and then like I said, they have to check it to take it in order to be checked by a state Game, Fish, and Parks employee. They then will collect a sample, which they send off to the lab that we're working with on this. Now, there is an important role that trappers have in terms of getting us data if they're willing to contribute data. So under those sort of regulatory checks, they're only required to notify the Game, Fish, and Parks employee of the county in which it was trapped. That's really useful for us, but actually we can get a tremendous amount of greater resolution in our data if we can get better location on those animals.
Oh, a GPS location?
GPS coordinates. It could be a description that allows us to, with some degree of confidence, place it on a map. Mm-hmm. If they can do that, that really helps us. And so we've set up essentially a link through my lab website, which allows them to submit data, and they can put the CITES tag number, their name, some additional information, and then let us know where that animal's captured. And then we can link those metadata together and connect it back to that genetic tissue.
So you've had 4 years of sampling, and so I'm wondering if you can share anything that you've learned so far.
Well, no, unfortunately.
I'm jumping the gun again.
Yeah. Okay. So we are using 4 years worth of sampling, but we are just initiating this project.
Okay.
The graduate student, Stuart Featherston, he is actually, as of today, in the lab, the genetics lab, starting to process these samples. So we are just starting to get data. In fact, we probably don't have any data yet.
Okay.
But hopefully we will have some very soon. But we are using data that had been collected over the last 4 years plus this year. So we'll have 5 years of data when all is said and done.
Okay. So you're just getting that in a place where you can then interpret it.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And so your second project is kind of looking at some camera surveys and other habitat sampling. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. This project, actually, they're really closely linked. So the first one that we mentioned was really looking at landscape connectivity and what factors on the landscape influence whether or not a bobcat might move into a new area or might be excluded from that area. One of the things about bobcat management in South Dakota is that historically, bobcat harvest was open all across the state. But then after 1977, it was reduced from 1977 to 2011 to only harvest west of the Missouri River. And more recently, due to some research that was done earlier in the 2000s, they reopened the harvest season, East River, so east of the Missouri River. And so they've done that, but we don't really know a whole lot about bobcat ecology in this area east of the Missouri River. And so Marlon Dart, who's a master student with me, he's looking at using camera traps in order to try to understand two really important things. The first is, you know, how widely distributed are bobcats in this region? And in particular, he's working in the Charles Mix, so the area just east of the river, Charles Mix County and the area just north of that. So how are they distributed in those areas? And then how do different landscape features influence the likelihood that they're going to occur there? And with a real interest here in trying to understand how these agricultural landscapes, because eastern South Dakota, as we all know, is much more irrigated croplands than western South Dakota. And so trying to understand how these landscape features associated with these agricultural sites, so things like shelter belts, how they might influence bobcat's ability to persist in an area.
So do you see more habitat, more people wanting to create habitat for bobcats in the eastern side of the state, or get rid of your habitat so you don't have bobcats in the eastern side of the state? Is that part of it, or what do you want? What's the lesson learned with this study?
Yeah, so so one of the real, you know, a lot of, there's not very many people I know or landowners that I talk to who have any distaste for bobcats. Most folks like bobcats. Why is that? I think it's because you don't see them. Right. You don't hear from them. But you know that they mean something about the integrity of the environment. You know, if bobcats are present, then you probably have a healthier environment than if they're not. And so, you know, as I mentioned in the first part, you know, talking about trapper harvested data, those trappers are essential for the work that we do. In eastern South Dakota, landowners are equally important. It's primarily private lands. And so we're working very closely with landowners to access their land and survey their land. I believe this past summer during our sampling, we contacted and interacted with close to 100 individual landowners to access their land. And the majority of these landowners are intrigued by bobcats. They're interested in them. And we don't see any real interest in, you know, folks wanting to get rid of bobcats, although we see a little bit different behavior towards coyotes.
Well, so what? Let's talk about the relationship between bobcats and coyotes and the ecosystem. And how do the two interact, and what does it mean?
Yeah, so bobcats and coyotes, I mean, they're going to be natural competitors with one another to some degree. They have dietary overlap, so they both will rely on small mammals and both rely on rabbits and hares as primary sources of food. And so there is some concern East River, east of the Missouri River, where perhaps, you know, if the landscape is not configured correctly, and I'll explain that in a moment, that maybe bobcats could be excluded by coyotes. And so what I mean by that is essentially one of the things we're trying to figure out is, are there certain patch sizes? So does a shelter belt need to be of a certain size in order to allow bobcats to use it in the presence of coyotes? And does that change if coyotes are absent? So if coyotes aren't on the landscape, or if they're in lower abundance, are bobcats more or less likely to occur there? So, you know, a real interest here is trying to understand these species interactions and how bobcats and coyotes might coexist within this agricultural matrix of a landscape.
Which would you rather have on your property?
I would prefer to have both.
And that's a healthier ecosystem, yes, then?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, The implication here is that if they're both co-occurring, that means that there's sufficient resources in order for them to be able to partition their resources in a way that they both occur. If resources are squeezed into a small area, or if there are very few prey items, so there's less diversity of prey, then they're more likely to be in competition with one another, or more strongly competing with one another, and that might lead to one or one of them being excluded, or in the case of bobcats, if they are inferior in terms of a competitive sort of nature with coyotes, that could result in both being excluded, because ultimately coyotes get persecuted a little bit more by humans. And so if bobcats disappear and then coyotes are also sort of persecuted, we could see the loss of both, and that's not good for the ecosystem either.
And in the few seconds that we have left, and if people want to learn more, is there a resource? Is there a website? Are you still just getting up and running here on getting this out?
Yeah, so there's a ton of information on South Dakota Game, Fish, and Parks' website related to bobcats. If you actually go to their website and click on the bobcat link, there is a link at the bottom that says, I believe it says additional bobcat harvest information. And if you click on that, it'll take you to our flyer and our link to our lab website, which will allow trappers to submit data. And if anybody has questions, I'm happy to get questions as well.
Okay. I want to thank you so very much for coming on the program today and laying this foundation. And I look forward to having you back with some of the results, some of your findings.
Thanks, Kara. I appreciate the time.
Thank you very much. Rob Longsinger is with the SDSU Department of Natural Resource Management as an assistant professor at SDSU, joining us from the Jeanine Basinger studio.